the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com. As your announcer told you, we're supported by listeners who subscribe to this program, like John Dickerson, Jason Ferguson, Joey Perillo, and Wendy Gebauer. If you'd like to join those ranks, follow the links under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, Kevin Gostola recaps the latest in the Bradley Manning court-martial hearing. We dug deep in the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives back to 1970 for the Hollies, and it's a song about working for the FBI. It's called Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. And joining me now is the author of an important new book called The Terror Factory. Journalist Trevor Aronson has studied the pattern of domestic terrorism investigations since September 11th, 2001. And I'm very pleased because he confirms some of the speculation that we have offered about the role of paid FBI informants and the overall pattern of domestic terrorism cases that really don't meet critical analysis, critical review. Trevor, thank you for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Now, you started this project when you were studying journalism across the bay from me at the University of California, Berkeley. And Lowell Bergman, a celebrated producer from CBS 60 Minutes, he helped break the tobacco story that CBS spiked for a period of time. He basically was your professor and really gave you the kind of support and encouragement you needed to take on an important and fairly comprehensive study like this.
Right. You know, Lowell Bergman runs an organization at Berkeley called the Investigative Reporting Program, and it's a separate nonprofit foundation-funded newsroom that's part of Berkeley. I wasn't necessarily studying journalism there. What Lowell does is every year he brings in three mid-career journalists who are given the resources to work on a very in-depth project that the private market or traditional media would not likely support. And so what I came to Lowell with was an idea about, you know, taking a really hard look at all of the terrorism prosecutions in the decade since 9/11. And so I was a fellow at Berkeley in 2002 and 2011, and we're aiming our project for release around the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And it ultimately became a Mother Jones story before it became my book. And what we wanted to show was the pattern of prosecutions in federal court on terrorism charges, and also how the FBI had developed, you know, overnight after 9/11, a very sophisticated and sometimes troubling counterterrorism policy that is intended to preempt the next attack. You know, overnight the FBI became an organization that was charged with investigating crime, and then it became one that was charged with becoming an intelligence agency that would find terrorists before they strike. And obviously, anytime you're looking to preempt crime or stop crime before it happens, it raises a lot of civil liberties concerns.
Well, indeed. And Trevor, I'm a little older, and I cut my teeth during the 1970s when J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO program was unraveling and becoming exposed. And in particular, I covered the trial of the survivors of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, who was set up and murdered by a Chicago police raid that was coordinated with the FBI. And the disclosures that came out of that exposed a massive program aimed at preventing the rise of a new black messiah. And so the racial angle of COINTELPRO is one of the prongs that made it sensational and compelling and led to what we thought there were the reforms that would prevent this from happening again. But after 9/11, newly minted FBI Director Mueller, Robert Mueller had been the U.S. attorney here in San Francisco, was just taking charge of the FBI, and he really reintroduced many of these tactics and techniques that we thought were outlawed and we would never see again. At least that was my impression.
Right. You know, I think a lot of people, when they think of abuses by the FBI, think of the 60s and the era that you described, the era that was really well documented by the Church Committee in showing the incredible abuses that the FBI did during that period. But the truth is that this story that I tell is not necessarily a new one so much as it's an evolution of that. It's an evolution of the older one. And to show you how much has changed, you know, during COINTELPRO and the era that everyone thinks of as being the most abusive era for the FBI, the FBI had 1,500 informants. You know, today under Mueller and after 9/11, the number of informants grew to what is now 15,000 informants. So we have 10 times the number of informants that we did during the COINTELPRO days. And what these informants are ultimately doing are investigating a number of crimes, but the FBI's top priority is counterterrorism. And the FBI views the greatest threat for terrorism from within Muslim communities. And so not unlike what we saw in the 60s when the FBI went after so-called dissident groups and Martin Luther King's organizations, we're seeing a singular targeting of Muslim communities by these informants because of the belief within the FBI that terrorism has its greatest threat from within those communities, even though, as we can talk about later, the data really doesn't support that. But what's happening is that the FBI is sending in informants looking for people interested in committing an act of terrorism. And for the most part, they're not finding many. But what they are finding are people who are economically desperate or mentally ill and people who say, I want to get involved in some sort of act of terrorism. People that on their own have no means of committing the crime. They don't have access to weapons. In most cases, they don't even have a car and they never have access or contacts with any international terrorists. But an FBI informant being an agent provocateur and posing as a terrorist operative will provide everything that the person needs, the weapon, the transportation, the money, everything. And once the person pushes the button expecting the bomb to blow up, a bomb that the FBI provided, they're arrested and then paraded out to the public as, you know, the FBI thwarting another attack and keeping you safe. But the truth is that the men caught in these terrorism stings never could have committed their crimes were it not for the FBI providing all of the means and opportunity that they needed.
Well, your description is very concise there, and the only thing I would add to it is that often they are providing the idea for the criminal plot, that these, you call them sad sacks, I usually call them schlubs, would never have come up with on their own.
You're right. You know, in many of these cases, the men at best have a vague idea that they want to get involved in some sort of violent act or act of terrorism, but never have any specific ideas. And it's the informant who provides the specific idea for the plot. A good example, and it's an absurd one, is this case in Illinois that involved this man named Derek Sharif. And Derek was down on his luck. He didn't have a place to live. His car was broken down. And an informant took him in, gave him a place to live, and over time was stoking Derek's anger. And, you know, Derek at one point angrily said, you know, I want to kill a judge. And of course, the informant, or I'm sorry, Derek couldn't even name a local judge's name. And so the informant then says, well, why don't we, you know, get involved in a more manageable plot? Why don't we attack a shopping mall? And of course, this was not Derek's idea. It was the informant's, and Derek handedly agrees and says, okay, let's attack a shopping mall. The problem for the FBI in that case was that they'd given Derek the idea to attack a shopping mall. But even if they introduced him to an arms dealer, which is what they wanted to do, to provide grenades that they'd use in their attack, Derek didn't have any money to buy those grenades. He was flat broke and he didn't have much of anything of value. And so the FBI informant and the agent cook up this plot where they say to Derek, hey, you know what? You've got these old stereo speakers. And I think, you know, my friend, the arms dealer, I think if we brought those stereo speakers to him, he would say, okay, I'll take the stereo speakers and here's four grenades in exchange. You know, I don't know many arms dealers, but I'm willing to bet that there aren't really any black market arms dealers who accept ratty old stereo speakers for black market grenades. But Derek didn't know that, and of course exchanges his old stereo speakers for grenades, and FBI agents roll in, arrest him, and charge him with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, and now he's serving 17 years in prison. But his was a case where he didn't even have the idea, and he didn't even have the means to acquire the weapons. The FBI had to go through this crazy contorted plot to use these stereo speakers to allow him to get the weapons that he could only be charged with trying to use.
Now, Trevor, when we finish the interview, I wonder if you'd give me that contact, because I've got some really cool custom-made stereo speakers in my garage, and I have zero weapons, and I don't know if I could get an anti-aircraft gun, an RPG. I'm not sure what the market would bear, but I'd sure like to see.
From Derek's case, it sounds like you'd be in store for some nice weaponry for what you have.
Trevor, you open the introduction to your book with the sad story of Michael Reynolds. Tell our listeners about him.
So Michael Reynolds was this man who was average in every way and then just could not reconcile that average life. He married young and he had a couple of kids, and his father-in-law helped him build a house. And typical of Michael Reynolds, he wanted to build this castle-like house with turrets and everything. And his father-in-law was like, no, you can't do that. And slowly Michael's what seemed to be mental illness came forward, and his relationship with his wife ended up ending, and he goes to live with his parents, his mom, in suburban Pennsylvania. And Michael became very angered with the Iraq war and decided that he wanted to do something about it. And so he goes on this Yahoo forum called OBL Crew, which was OBL for Osama bin Laden.
Really discreet.
And, you know, Michael, apparently not being the savviest of would-be terrorists, really thought this was a forum where, you know, Al-Qaeda operatives would talk and communicate about plots, you know, out in the open on some Yahoo group. So he posts this message on OBL Crew saying he wants to commit some sort of act of terrorism. He wants to blow up the Trans-Canada pipeline, and he needs help. And, of course, no one responds. And he comes back and he says, you know, this is a great idea. I'd like to move forward with it. You know, I need some help. And finally, an FBI informant sees that and starts emailing him and claims to be an Al-Qaeda operative who can provide everything that he would need. I think the number was $50,000 that he would provide, as well as the logistics and help in getting together weapons that he would use to bomb the pipeline. And so Michael Curtis Reynolds travels to Idaho expecting to meet this operative who will provide everything, this $50,000. And when he arrives at this rest stop, this interstate rest stop in Idaho, instead of finding an Al-Qaeda operative, he instead finds FBI agents who arrest him and charge him with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction. And he was sentenced to also about 17 years in prison. Later, the FBI admitted that, you know what, Michael Curtis Reynolds wasn't so much a threat as he was mentally ill. And what's illustrative about Reynolds' case is that he's very similar to many of the other terrorist plots that you see the FBI announce and say we've thwarted. They don't involve people who on their own have the capacity, who have the weapons, have the ability to move forward in the plots. There are these crazy, you know, as I put, sad sacks who have this vague idea at best, no access to weapons, and the FBI through these elaborate sting operations provides everything that they need. You know, what the FBI says is that they're doing this, by doing this, they're preventing real Al-Qaeda operatives from empowering these would-be terrorists. But the truth is that we have yet to see a case of, you know, some Al-Qaeda recruiter operating in the United States, you know, willing and able to provide weapons to, you know, these doofuses who on their own can't acquire them. In truth, it's only the FBI through these sting operations that is empowering people on the fringes of society who aspire to violence but have no means on their own.
And Trevor, my own antenna went up first when I heard the Lodi Mosque case of father and son who had traveled to Pakistan, and there was the insertion of a paid FBI informant with a criminal record. Then the Lackawanna Six. Then the Fort Dix case. Then the group in South Florida with the FBI informant who had them buy uniforms and pledge a loyalty oath to Al-Qaeda. And as this pattern began to emerge, I started talking about this and raising questions. And then it was a couple of years back, the New York Times did publish a story where they acknowledged that in at least two dozen cases, there are serious questions about the validity of the investigation and prosecution because of the role of a paid FBI informant slash provocateur. As you were pulling together this comprehensive analysis and trying to look at the patterns of these investigations and prosecutions, you got a break. When, in the contentious hearings related to whether or not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed could be tried in the United States, the Justice Department released a report identifying 400 suspects, or is it 400 cases or a total of 400 individuals who have been investigated and charged since 9/11?
Yeah, individual defendants, about 400 individual defendants.
Okay, so we have an army of 15,000 informants. We have 400 suspects, let's call them that. And is there any indication that any of these were real terrorists?
One of the hurdles in a project like mine early on was, how do you do a comprehensive review of terrorism cases when you're opening yourself up to this situation where you might pull together hundreds of terrorism cases and the Department of Justice will say, okay, nice job with your analysis, but the problem is that, you know, a bunch of these cases we don't consider terrorism cases. So my lucky break, you're right, came when Attorney General Eric Holder testified before Congress in the DOJ's effort to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to trial in Manhattan, a plan that they ultimately dropped in favor of Guantanamo Bay. But in his hearing, he provided that list of more than 400 defendants as a way of saying, look at this. These are the defendants that since 9/11 we've successfully prosecuted for terrorism. And this is the formula by which we define what a international terrorism case is. So I took, with a research assistant, those 400 defendants and then used the formula that Holder provided to update that list to the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And that brought us up to about 508 defendants. And what's really striking about that is that of the 508 defendants, an informant was used in approximately half of those cases. The other half of the cases were charges that you wouldn't necessarily relate to terrorism. They were things like lying to the FBI or immigration violations, charges that the FBI and Department of Justice say, okay, this guy committed a crime and we think he's tangentially related to terrorists, but his ultimate crime really had nothing to do with terrorism per se. The other half, the half that involved informants, of those 250-some cases, 150 were sting operations, where people like Derek Sharif that I described earlier, people who did not have access to weapons, did not have connections to terrorists, but were able to move forward in their plot because the FBI provided all of the means and the opportunity. So you had 150 of those cases. And then when you drill down further and you say, okay, of these 500 cases, how many involved someone who was about to launch an attack, had the means and opportunity to do some really bad stuff? And the truth is that there's only a handful of those. Najibullah Zazi, for example, was a man who came close to bombing New York City subway system. You remember Faiz Shahzad, for example, he delivered a bomb to Times Square that fortunately didn't go off. And ironically, the FBI knew nothing about him until he delivered that bomb. And then you have the folks that get the funny names like Jose Padilla, the dirty bomber and the shoe bomber and the underwear bomber. But really, those five are the ones on the list who presented a significant threat. The rest, the 150 cases in sting operations, these were people that on their own had no capacity for terrorism, but were made capable of committing an act of terrorism through this FBI sting. And yet those 150 people are the ones that the DOJ and the FBI constantly put forward to the public and saying, look at us, we're keeping you safe. But the truth is, if you look closely at those cases, the men charged with terrorism, the men paraded out as being people caught before they were able to act, never could have acted were it not for the FBI giving them all of the means and the opportunity.
And these are made for TV mini-dramas, really. That's what the FBI is serving up. These people are simply pawns in a propaganda machine.
In a sense, you're right. And what this gets at, in many ways, is, you know, the FBI is traditionally a law enforcement organization. And as any law enforcement organization does, it measures its success and its job in the number of arrests made, the number of prosecutions made, just as a local police department does. But what's happened after 9/11 is that the FBI transformed into also being an intelligence agency. And how do you really trumpet to the public your successes as an intelligence agency when the whole nature of being an intelligence agency is that you don't talk about what you do? And so what this has created has been pressure on the FBI to show that it's doing its job to keep us safe. And if it was really keeping us safe, it's thwarting these attacks that we could never know about, then it would never be able to tell us anything about these attacks. But these FBI terrorism stings provide a very convenient mechanism for the FBI to say, look at us, this is us keeping you safe. And what drives this is really political in nature. Every year, the Congress sets the FBI's budget. And every year, counterterrorism is the largest part of that budget. It gets $3 billion for counterterrorism, which is more than the FBI receives for organized crime, financial fraud, and other areas that were traditionally the areas of focus for the FBI prior to 9/11. And so that puts pressure on the top levels of the FBI to find terrorists and show to Congress that it's keeping us safe. That pressure then gets put down on local offices, who then put that pressure down on agents, who then put that pressure in turn on informants, who are paid lots of money to go into communities and find would-be terrorists. These informants know that if they find a would-be terrorist, they can make six-figure paydays, $100,000 or more. And so they're going into these communities, and they're not truly finding someone who's putting a bomb together. Instead, they're finding someone who's mentally ill or economically desperate, who they're able to walk through in a plot, knowing that if they end up getting them involved in a sting operation, there's a big payday on the line for them. So then this is as much, in my view, a story of terrorism as it is a story about justice in the United States and the fairness and administration of justice in the United States, because we're sending into Muslim communities these criminals and con men who are informants with a financial incentive in finding people who will commit acts of terrorism. And then when they get them along in a plot, it then runs up the flagpole up to the highest levels of the FBI, who then say, look at us, America, this is us keeping you safe, and then further justifying their counterterrorism budget for the next year.
Trevor, where does the money come from to pay the informants? Is it from drug seizures or other government seizures, or is there a line item in the FBI budget for millions of dollars worth of payments to informants?
Yeah, I wish there were a line item, because that's my big question, too. The reason we know what informants make, and I should preface this by saying this is a closely held secret within the FBI, what they pay informants overall, what they pay individual informants, how much money a prolific informant might make from the FBI during his career as an informant. All of that is a very closely held secret. But the reason we get glimpses at this is that when some of these terrorism cases go to trial, very good defense attorneys will try to undermine the credibility of the informant by asking how much he was paid for these cases. And what we know, for example, is that in the case outside New York, a case known as the Newburgh Four, the informant was paid $96,000 for his role in the case. In the Lodi case, for example, the informant was paid $300,000 for his role in the case. And these are people, informants, who, for the most part, don't have great career prospects on their own. These are not people who could go and get a good job, a good paying job, were it not for their gig with the FBI.
Well, most of them are compromised either as suspects or convicts in drug cases or other crimes, and they can't get a job, and they're either on probation or somehow in contact with the FBI when they're approached and say, hey, you want to make some money?
You're right. You know, I think it's important to realize that likely informants are not me or you or many of your listeners. A federal judge described an informant to me as being a sociopath, and that the only good informants are sociopaths. And what he meant by that is that informants are people who, by their nature, need to develop close relationships with people, become their best friend over months, even years, and then be willing to betray that relationship for personal gain when the hammer comes down and they're charged with a crime. And that's not something the average person can do and can live with. But what ends up happening is that the FBI finds these people through their committing crimes on their own. You know, oftentimes these are informants are drug dealers and con men. The man who was the informant in the Newburgh Four case, for example, had fled Pakistan because he was accused of murder there, and then came to the United States and did a number of cons that ultimately he was charged for, and the FBI used that as leverage to get him to become an informant. He then transitioned into a paid informant, and you know, we're paying him six figures every year to go into Muslim communities and become an agent provocateur and lure in people who on their own can't commit crimes, but armed with this informant at their side are able to obtain sophisticated weapons that even, you know, the biggest organized criminal organization couldn't obtain in the United States.
Well, and these informants need to either get an agent or unionize, because the wide range of payments is something they ought to get under control. We've just learned that the FBI inserted a paid informant into WikiLeaks. He's a cherubic young guy, I think from Austria, named Sigurdur Þórðarson. And he infiltrated WikiLeaks. There's a picture of him with Julian Assange. And he only got $5,000 for 3 months of undercover work. I mean, these guys really need to get it together.
And yeah, he needs to do some better negotiation, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's minimum. That's minimum wage stuff.
Yeah, it really does run the gamut based on, you know, what these informants are paid. In terrorism cases, though, you know, from what I've seen, $25,000 to $40,000 tends to be on the low end, and you know, you see informants making $100,000 or more. The Lodi informant is the so far the record, I believe. I think $300,000 is the most I've seen documented for a single payment to an informant.
And Trevor, do you have any indication that any of these people have had to go into the witness protection program? Because that's a nice gravy train.
Not yet. You know, what we do see, though, is that when the FBI uses many of these informants over and over in case after case. And they do that by plopping them down in new cities. So, for example, the informant that I described in the Newburgh 4 case originally operated in Albany, New York. And then his cover was blown, of course, once they announced the first case. And then they moved him to New York City, where he worked a case in Newburgh. And then most recently, they moved him to Pittsburgh, where he was working a case. But ironically, this informant was a man I'd written extensively about in the Mother Jones story. And the Mother Jones story had included a photograph of him. And as it turns out, in my Mother Jones story, I included a number of documents from this guy's cases that included the cell phone he was using when he was working on one of these cases. And so fast forward now, about a year ago, he's working a case in Pittsburgh, and they're targeting this man named Alakili. And Alakili describes how he was given a business card from the informant, and he was suspicious of him. So he Googles his number, puts his phone number in Google, and it brings up the court record of him in the Newburgh case. And then he finds my story and realizes that's the same guy, the picture of him. And, of course, the cover is blown. But from what I'm hearing, the FBI, Shahed Hussein, the informant, is still being used by the FBI. They're just able to shuffle them around from city to city so that they're not otherwise recognized by the community.
Trevor, to what extent has the revelations in more than 1 year, it's been a pattern that the Justice Department Inspector General reports widespread abuse of national security letters. These are the instant warrants that don't require a court approval that an FBI agent essentially can just execute on his or her own. And the IG has said that in thousands of cases, they improperly used that authority. Have you seen any overlap between the abuse of NSLs and these trumped-up cases of domestic terrorism?
You know, what the NSL letters get at is a pattern within the FBI that since 9/11, you've really seen an erosion of the need for what's called a predicate in launching an investigation. You know, traditionally, the FBI needed what's called a predicate, which is a belief or evidence to suggest that the person they're investigating was involved in some sort of crime prior to their ability to get warrants, to dig up information, to investigate them at all. And after 9/11, there was the allowance of the NSLs, as well as what's called threat assessments, which is a 72-hour period where the FBI, just based on a tip, based on maybe you going to the FBI and say, you know what, I think Trevor Aronson is involved in terrorism. The FBI can use that to launch a threat assessment against me for 72 hours and pull up as much information as they can, go through my trash, go through my email, go through my phone records, looking for anything that could further justify an investigation, could further establish the predicate. And what we see in case after case in terrorism is that the FBI is really using very flimsy evidence or flimsy tips to justify that threat assessment, which then gives them the ability to establish a predicate. You know, look at anyone's life very closely for 72 hours, and you're probably going to get enough to move forward in some sort of investigation. And so what we see, for example, is the FBI launching investigations based on people's, you know, exercising of their First Amendment rights. You know, oftentimes investigations in terrorism cases are start from nothing more than someone going on Facebook and posting something really stupid, really odious, but otherwise protected speech in America, you know, something about wanting to get involved in jihad or whatever it might be. And that's enough for them, the FBI, to launch an investigation. And in turn, that's been enough for them to use NSLs to go to Google and other companies looking for information on the people involved. And I think that's the really troubling case here, is that in so many ways we've allowed the fear of terrorism and national security to slowly erode these safeguards that we had in place to prevent abuses of power by the FBI in their investigation of crimes.
Now, recently here on my program, I've been doing some coverage with reporter Bo Hodai of the use of the Department of Homeland Security, which has created so-called fusion centers that coordinate efforts between the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and local law enforcement. Did your investigations of these domestic terrorism cases show any involvement with DHS and these fusion centers?
Yeah, so it's important to understand the kind of the landscape of counterterrorism today. So one of the things that existed prior to 9/11 but really exploded after 9/11 was the so-called Joint Terrorism Task Force. And what that is in every major city, there is a JTTF that brings together the FBI, DHS, Secret Service, ICE, and a host of federal and local law enforcement entities. And the idea is that they are to share information and provide resources to each other. So in fact, that even under the JTTF, local sheriff's office deputies and local police officers are sometimes deputized as federal agents, where they don't even provide information to their police chief about what they're doing at the JTTF. What we see in these cases is a cooperation in investigations of sting operations, but also close cooperation among agencies. It's common, for example, for the FBI to use ICE, immigration as leverage to recruit an informant. So what ends up happening is the FBI will go into Muslim communities, identify people that they're interested in, and if they find he's on shaky immigration ground, or let's say, for example, his immigration status is fine, but he's trying to get his family over from overseas, they will use that as leverage with the cooperation of ICE to say, you know what, unless you work with us, you're going to face deportation. And if they don't work with them, lo and behold, they're ultimately brought with deportation proceedings against them. More troubling is the involvement of these fusion centers, which are usually established by local law enforcement to provide kind of intelligence gathering mechanism by local law enforcement agencies. Local law enforcement agencies file what are known as suspicious activities reports, or SARs, and these local law enforcement officials are trained to believe that, okay, well, we are on the lookout street by street for terrorist organizations and terrorists, and when we see anything suspicious, we will report that to the fusion centers that will provide analysis and then float that information up to the FBI. In Florida here, for example, we were able to obtain some of the suspicious activities reports that were filed by local police officers, and they are things that are just patently ridiculous. You know, a Muslim man walking in a parking lot prompts local police to issue a SARS report. But what this is ultimately doing is you know, and this should be troubling in the context of what we found out about NSA, is that the FBI, through the fusion centers and through cooperation with law enforcement nationwide, are really just building the intelligence capacity nationwide and pulling in people and gathering information on them, even though they have not had any evidence that those people have committed crimes.
Well, and we just reported this week about the widespread use of these license plate reading devices that collects then massive amounts of data on the movements of innocent people that can be shared regionally, sometimes nationally. You put that together with the driver's license photo database that is now accessed at the federal level. And it really is a very pervasive network that meets the definition of a police state, at least in my humble opinion. Trevor, I want to ask you about one case that just has sent my bullshit detector into overdrive, and that is this guy Arbabsiar. He recently took a guilty plea and was sentenced to more than 20 years in federal prison. And a result of that plea deal, we'll never really see an airing of the accusations against him. He's an Iranian-American used car dealer from South Texas. He allegedly hatched a plot in collusion with a guy who he thought was a Mexican drug cartel representative, but in fact was a DEA agent. And we're told that there were two wire transfers of about $50,000 from Tehran to an American bank account, and that the plot was that this guy, Arbabsiar, was going to blow up a restaurant in Washington, D.C. to take out the Saudi ambassador. And this story was floated. He was convicted Nancy Grace style in the media with very little evidence offered, really just the wire transfers were the so-called smoking guns. Then, because he took the guilty plea, there is no airing out of the charges, no evaluation of how much of this actually is true. But I've talked to a number of experts on international espionage and counterterrorism, and not one of them believes that this is a valid case.
Yeah, I mean, in my conversations with people about this case, that's been their assessment as well. I mean, the idea that the Iranian government, with whose capacity for espionage and work overseas, you know, certainly is not insignificant, would partner with a drug cartel in Mexico, you know, really strains credulity, I think. And I think that's what set a lot of people's bullshit detector off, which is how credible is it that this guy working at a used car lot in Texas is somehow an Iranian agent, and his partnership with a drug cartel will allow him to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. What's telling about this case is that it's like so many of the counterterrorism cases that we see, in that oftentimes we don't get a full glimpse of the evidence involved because of the guilty pleas that are ultimately brought in these cases. And the reason that this man probably pleaded guilty is the same reason that so many people charged with terrorism often plead guilty, which is that faced with terrorism, you face draconian mandatory minimum sentences that were really designed for, you know, the Osama bin Ladens of the world. And so when you're charged with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction or conspiracy to commit some sort of act of terrorism, you're facing sentences of 25, 40 years, even life, or you face the possibility of pleading guilty and taking 15, 12 years, depending on the circumstances of the case. And what most people charged with cases like this see is that the likelihood of getting off, the likelihood of being Muslim in the United States charged with terrorism and getting off, is slim to none. You know, the only cases where someone has actually gotten off were two defendants of the seven in the Liberty City 7 case were found not guilty. That case was somewhat anomalous, but for the most part, the federal prosecution has a near perfect record in terrorism cases. And so what we see are these really strange cases that you know, whose factors and whose circumstances really suggest that this is not the most credible threat. But because the defendant faces these draconian sentences if he brings it to trial and loses, they often plead guilty, and we never get a full airing of what was involved in the case.
And Trevor, similarly, I released an interview this week with the father of John Philip Walker Lind, who is America's detainee 001. He was the first guy picked up and accused of being an American Taliban. And all those charges were dropped. He pled guilty ultimately to violating the sanctions on Afghanistan, the commercial sanctions. And the law that he pled guilty to only provides for a 10-year sentence. Nevertheless, the White House insisted on a 20-year sentence, and he accepted that plea bargain. And it's exactly the same rationale you just described, that in the toxic environment post 9/11, and the way he was vilified on the cover of Newsweek and elsewhere, John Lind had no prayer for a real fair trial. And it's a real travesty, because he had volunteered to fight in the Afghan army against the warlords who were on the opposition of the United States until 9/11. And he didn't even know of the geopolitical flip that basically left him as the odd man out. I also want to just briefly ask you, you mentioned in The Real Terrorist, the real domestic terrorist, Jose Padilla. And I have never known what the truth is about him, and also because he took a plea bargain, there was no trial, and so the evidence will never be presented in public. But all of the terrorism-related charges against him were ultimately dropped after his 3-plus years of Gitmo-style treatment in the brig in North Carolina. So
right.
Can you tell me just briefly why you consider him to be a real terrorist? Because, again, I don't pretend to know, but the allegations made by John Ashcroft in Moscow that were used to convict him in the media were ultimately not proven.
you're right. You know, in studies like this, and in the study I did of these cases, I tried to be as generous as possible to the government in the sense that if they are connected to terrorists in some way, that they have these tangible connections, you could describe them as terrorists, even though those connections might not have given them the capacity to do what the government ultimately alleges they wanted to do. So in the case of Jose Padilla, you know, there is a clear record that he was connected to Al-Qaeda through Al-Qaeda officials overseas, mm-hmm. and that he had gone overseas and he'd lived with them, and he had in fact married a woman who was closely connected to an Al-Qaeda operative. The government later alleged, of course, that he had been trained to unleash a radioactive dirty bomb, and that's what he was moving forward in doing. They were never able to prove that in court. Ultimately, what they were able to prove was a type of conspiracy in which the people he was involved with were using code that the government claimed was related to terrorism. They were talking about soccer and footballs and fields, and the claim was that this was code for different various terrorist acts. In my view, and kind of being generous about this to the federal government, because Jose Padilla had these connections and had gone overseas, I'm okay with the idea that we're going to describe him as a real terrorist. But you're right. I mean, the question is, was he really the dirty bomber that the government claims him to be? And the government wasn't able to establish that evidence, even with the controversial distinction of his being a so-called enemy combatant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So finally, I'd like to ask you about the tenure of Robert Mueller as FBI director. After the abuses of J. Edgar Hoover, they passed a law that said an FBI director shall serve a single term of 10 years. And then 2 years ago, they just quietly extended Mueller's term with no debate. I was debating it, but nobody was listening. And now they've appointed James Comey. And we're hearing again about the Ashcroft bedside encounter in 2004, which is supposed to be James Comey's shining moment. But the truth is that he approved virtually all of the what I consider to be the unconstitutional actions of the Bush administration, from the setup of Guantanamo to the torture regime to rendition. And while he had quibbles about the collection of metadata, he ultimately agreed that they, you know, shifted some things around. We don't know all the details, but he did ultimately approve that. So do you see any difference between Mueller and Comey? And do you have any other comments you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, what was most troubling about the fact that Mueller's tenure was extended without much discussion or debate is the fact that the 10-year maximum tenure for an FBI director was established as a result of the abuses that we saw under J. Edgar Hoover, where J. Edgar Hoover had stayed in the position for decades and had been allowed to basically run the FBI as his own little secret police force. And so this 10-year maximum was intended to prevent that from happening again. Yet here we are, was in 2012. We said, okay, let's go ahead and extend Mueller's tenure under the auspices that there was an election coming up and it would have been messy time to switch FBI directors at a time of such heightened national security in the federal government's view. And so now we have James Comey coming in, and the idea that a new FBI director may reassess some of the problematic policies that we've seen in the decades since 9/11, that hope really doesn't exist under Comey, because what we know is that Comey has been a very ardent supporter of sting operations, of the use of preemptive prosecution in terrorism cases. He specifically oversaw a very troubling sting operation that occurred in Albany at New York, for example. And so I'm not expecting any difference in policy or any kind of policy shift under Comey. I mean, in some ways, this is just a continuation of the same with Comey. At the same time, I think we may even see more aggressive use of these tactics in other areas, such as the use of informants and agent provocateurs in cyber terrorism, for example, or hacking, or, a continuing crackdown on leaks from within the government, particularly since Edward Snowden released the documents on the NSA. And so I don't think we're going to see any sort of kinder, gentler FBI. But under Comey, what I think we're going to see is an FBI that is as singularly focused on terrorism as Mueller was, maybe even with a secondary focus in cyber terrorism, but with a continued effort to continue the policy that Mueller had, which is, at whatever cost, never again, never have another terrorist attack. And what that will mean is the continued use of aggressive informants and agent provocateurs operating in cases that are meant to preempt crime rather than necessarily prevent it.
Well, I would like to recommend that every member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which will preside over the confirmation hearings of James Comey, reads your book, because these are things that should be explored in open forums and should be a part of this confirmation process. The Congress has failed in its oversight responsibilities, and the Senate in particular is very cozy with the FBI and the intelligence communities. Nevertheless, I hope, because we do have Ed Markey, new from Massachusetts, the senators from Oregon, Wyden and Merkley, have shown real independence and a desire to represent the people. And maybe if everybody in Washington read your book, things might change a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is an area where I wish Congress would ask questions and pursue. You know, in the wake of the Boston bombing, for example, I was really hopeful that that might actually happen. I mean, I think what the Boston bombing showed very clearly was that, you know, the FBI's policies and sting operations have shown to be very effective in finding people on the margins of society who don't have capacity to commit a crime were it not for the FBI providing that capacity. At the same time, the FBI has been missing the truly dangerous threats. You know, they didn't know who Faisal Shahzad was until he delivered a bomb to Times Square, just as they didn't know Tamerlan Tsarnaev was a threat, even though they'd investigated him. So I think the FBI has clearly shown an inability to identify the truly dangerous threats, to identify the people who can commit acts of terrorism without needing an FBI informant dragging them by the nose and providing them with the bomb to detonate.
Trevor Aronson, the new book is called The Terror Factory. I read it as an e-book. Where's the best place for people to get it?
It should be available at your local bookseller, but Amazon.com always has it in stock and is a great place to get it as well.
Okay. Thanks for talking with us today.
Great. Thank you so much.
Segment two of the Peter B. Collins podcast. We get a recap of recent developments at the court-martial of Bradley Manning, taking place at Fort Meade, Maryland. And the guy who's on top of the story, live blogging it on a daily basis over at firedoglake.com, is a great journalist, Kevin Gostola, who returns to our program today. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Peter.
I was at Netroots Nation last week, so we didn't do a recap. It's been two full weeks since we last spoke. Could you help our listeners out with just a quick thumbnail of the key events, testimony, evidence that has been presented at this trial in the last 2 weeks, please?
Last week, we had the military prosecutors say in court that a WikiLeaks Most Wanted list, it was a crowdsourced list put together in 2009 from journalists, activists, historians, lawyers, police, etc., of, you know, basically good gets, some leaks that people would like to see WikiLeaks publish. They had this entered to show that Manning had knowledge that his act would basically aid the enemy. The defense objected to it being entered. There was a former JTF Gitmo commander named Rear Admiral David Woods who had his testimony on the Guantanamo files entered into the record. There was a global address list, email address list that Manning is accused of stealing. That was discussed in court. We had other testimony from a senior counterterror analyst on the Guantanamo files. And outside of the court, but also critical to the court martial, the Center for Constitutional Rights motion for a preliminary injunction was denied in a federal court in Baltimore.
And the nature of the injunction sought was, Kevin?
They wanted to give press contemporaneous access to documents in the court martial, which would mean if a ruling was issued, you would have it instantly provided to you and you would be able to do it for reporting. That was denied because the judge said that the government was now providing documents on a timely basis.
If that were the case, then the suit wouldn't be required. The call for an injunction wouldn't even be contemplated.
That is true. And for example, the absurdity of secrecy. I've started to do these secrecy updates on Twitter every time they do something that makes absolutely no sense. We were given a list of, we were giving a stipulated testimony that had the list of U.S. cables, which we'll be getting into in this segment. And I wanted to copy down all of the message record numbers, which I can describe after I share this anecdote. But the military said we could not take this copy home with us for our reporting. It had to stay in the media center. They were going to collect it from us after an hour, and we only had an hour to work with it. And there were 117 different things we had to copy down. It took me almost an hour to copy what I needed. I felt like I was a congressman going into one of those secret padded rooms to look at the drone memos.
Or maybe a reporter given the chance to spend 20 minutes with Mitt Romney's tax returns.
Yes.
And so who prevailed in that tug of war?
Well, they kept their document. They said the judge said you couldn't have it. It's going to be up. We have got a Freedom of Information Act reading room. So there are materials online that people can access. I'm not sure that the public understands that it is a resource that's available and that this material is being made available if they want to read it. But that's there. And mm-hmm. then we have the stenographer who's been crowdfunded from the Freedom of the Press Foundation continues to show up. We've got the transcripts. There's a level of transparency, but it was a tug of war to get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about this specific list of cables, because from reading your blog post at firedoglake.com, I come away with the sense that these are not controversial cables. These are not the ones that the government would argue are sensitive or that compromise sources and methods or tactics or that in the broader sense would give any aid or comfort to some presumed enemy.
That's perhaps the case. I think that there's two routes we could go with this discussion, and hopefully we have time to get into both areas. So the first thing I'll say is I agree that they look like really innocent, meaningless cables. And if you look at them, you can't remember them. I'm a reporter who covered the cables as they were being published by New York Times, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, other outlets. I was following the releases as they were given attention, and I was collecting the revelations and trying to do a tally in my head of what was significant. Just for a quick example, one of my more favorite disclosures had to do with President of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, and this meeting with General David Petraeus, where he said to Petraeus that he would agree to say that the bombs were ours and not yours. And he was talking about covering up the role of the U.S. and having drone strikes in Yemen. That cable is not a charged cable. It's not one of the ones of the 117 that Manning is charged with releasing to WikiLeaks. Quickly, there are 117 cables charged.
Mm-hmm.
96 of them are classified confidential. There are 21 that are classified at the secret level. And then there are two uncharged cables, which maybe we can mention later on in the segment, but what I think is true is if you look at these, it doesn't appear that this is anything that we remember, like Saudi Arabia is funding international terrorism or the UN is spying on diplomats. But if you use the wikileaks.org/+D search engine, which people can go to pull up any of these cables, what you'll notice is it has tags, and sometimes some of these cables I've found do have tags of like terrorism or do have tags that might suggest a reason behind charging Manning with releasing.
Mm-hmm.
The Kabul, Afghanistan cables, as I glanced at them, I could come up with a reason in my mind, though I wouldn't charge Manning with the disclosures of the cables. But if I was a prosecutor and I was picking those cables, I may be willing to charge Manning because they were about the Afghan National Police. They were about trying to get security in Afghanistan. I suppose it would be possible that if you were charged, if you were going to charge somebody, that those would be cables you would pick.
And so what is your speculation as to why the government is using relatively benign evidence from the massive numbers of files that were ultimately released to press its case and to try to win the maximum penalty against Manning in this court-martial proceeding?
First off, the State Department only has to bring out a certain amount of cables from the well over 250,000 documents. And in truth, it doesn't quite matter what the contents of the cables are. If you go off military prosecutors' argument, they'll just say these are confidential, they have national security information, these are secret, they have national security information too. That makes Manning guilty of aiding the enemy. That helps us prove that charge. Now proceed onward. So there's that. But then there's also, I think, the political reality, the choice that the State Department is making. They wanted this to be as innocent as possible. They have not wanted to attract much attention to their involvement. And I say this realizing that earlier on in the process, Manning's defense lawyer, David Coombs, wanted a damage assessment report from mm-hmm. the State Department that he could use to prove there had been no harm.
Right.
The State Department was an agency that fought more than any other agency to not have that damage report provided to him to be used in the court-martial. And so I think that by picking these seemingly innocuous cables that we don't remember anything about, we don't remember reading them back in 2010 or 2011, they're trying to minimize attention. They don't want you and I to be having a conversation about those contents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're mixing up here because maybe we think that the cables that got the most attention were the ones that were the most damaging to the State Department. And maybe that's not true. Maybe there are cables that we didn't cover back in 2011 that were far more damaging
yeah.
in the eyes of the State Department.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make, because with the just massive amount of data, it was almost impossible to go through it all. And so certainly some things that might be considered newsworthy or, you know, very damaging didn't get highlighted. Now, you identified this pool of cables. 21 of them were designated as secret. That is the highest designation of anything that Bradley Manning released. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I believe so.
Nothing top secret.
There's no top secret. And so, you know, I spoke to Foreign Service Officer, veteran, former Foreign Service Officer Peter Van Buren, who relayed to me that from his experience in the State Department, and you can read about it in my post, he gave me some good insights into these cables. He was able to tell me that the really sensitive information that the department wouldn't have want to be released, that would have been in a top secret cable, or they might have just had the conversation over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
They would have had it over the phone so it wasn't in print, and you and I couldn't submit a Freedom of Information Act request to get a copy of it later on down the road.
So, Kevin, 21 secret, over 80 confidential, 2 that were kind of uncategorized. Do you think that is proportional to the breakdown of the 250,000 separate documents? And has the prosecution made that argument? Is this a representative cross-section of the material leaked?
I can't say much about the numbers. It's not clear to me why they went with 117. I think what is clear, though, is they weren't going to charge him with every single cable. And, you know, the same goes for the war logs and from Afghanistan and Iraq. They didn't charge every tens of thousands of military incident report. They picked the ones that would be easy to prove the charges. And so I think they think that these cables are going to make it easiest to prove the charge that he faces for unauthorized disclosure of the information.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Kevin, a moment ago you alluded to a second track or path here. You want to lay that out for us now?
Well, actually, I ended up weaving it in both ways because,
oh, okay.
As I said, I thought that you could either say that they don't want to attract attention, or you could say that we misunderstood the importance of these cables to the State Department, that if you were able to get in a room where they would open up to you, maybe an official would tell you that they were deeply offended by some of these cables. But I'm just saying to an outside observer, if you read through these and if you look at them, you know, just a quick thing about the process of putting together a cable. A lot of diplomats, when they're at meetings or these people who have signing their name to them that wrote these are basically acting as journalists. They write up a report on a meeting and they say who was there. And then they classify it, usually higher than they should, and then it goes into the secret government network known as CIPRNet, and it would have been widely available for people to access in government and use for whatever purpose. And so a lot of these are very standard. There's nothing significant in a lot of these in the sense that nobody is being asked to do anything, and there's no clear indication that people are being asked to do any cover-up. I mean, if you look at these, it's a standard business for the United States government. That doesn't mean it's legal or that it isn't underhanded dealings or anything backroom that Bradley Manning would have been offended by, but I'm just saying that it's not, like, obvious that it's a scandal.
Mm-hmm. And so with this list of the 117 cables that are being introduced into evidence, as a journalist, what do you care to say about your next steps? What are you going to do with that information, Kevin?
There's multiple things that I think should happen with the information. I thought for a long time that a lot of people just do not know about the cables that have been released and don't understand the significance. And now there's a bit of a quandary or dilemma here for me, because these aren't the 117 diplomatic cables that I would like to talk about with the public to make sure that they still understand. These aren't the cables that I think Bradley Manning disclosed the United States Embassy cable cache to the public for them to read. I don't think this involves any of the material that he wanted us to take a look at. But on the other hand, it's very interesting and revealing about our government that these are the ones that the military prosecutors have picked. So it falls on me, one of the few reporters, to try to go through and see if there's anything interesting about them. I started to glance through the Kabul, Afghanistan ones. I noticed that the most cables that were charged from any diplomatic post were from Baghdad, and they were charged, a lot of them were from June 2007. And Van Buren told me that, as he had been following Iraq, that 2006 had been a very important year for the military, because that's when the surge happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2007 had been a big year for the State Department, because they were going to prove that they were capable of making political progress in Iraq. And they, you know, if you read his book, you can figure out if you agree that they were able to do what they committed to doing. But I guess I can see where they would have been sensitive to the release of Baghdad cable. So I guess, you know, as I go forward, I'm still covering the trial. There's not a whole lot I can do immediately, but there's some that I intend to do over the weekend. If people want to look at firedoglake.com, there could be a second post that follows up on what I've reported so far. And then later on, getting back into the cables, because I think that we really don't understand. And I think somebody should be taking the step of putting together a book that really gets into it. But I just, it's so vast, and I don't think we really understand how significant this entire release of over 250,000 cables happens to be.
So let's turn now to the testimony of Rear Admiral David Woods, the former commander of Guantanamo prison camp. What did he bring to the testimony, and do you feel that it advanced the government's case against Manning?
This Rear Admiral, as he was coming forward, you know, a lot of these people are acting as original classification authorities, people who are capable of reviewing the information and determining whether it was properly classified. He looked at some documents. He said, I think what was really fascinating to me is how he looked over it and he found that it contained intelligence data. He said that it, quote, included descriptions of detainees' biographical information, the circumstances of his capture, what he did in his possession, what he had in his possession when he was captured, the circumstances and date of his transfer to Guantanamo, his travel, his affiliations with individuals and organizations of intelligence interest, etc. And one of the things that I quote from another senior counterterrorism analyst that testified on the same, along the same lines, was that he said, I understand that all of this data would be known to the detainee and may be known by his associates listed. However, since we usually do not learn all of this information from the detainee himself, the detainee may not understand the extent of what the United States knows about either his background information, his capture, or his affiliation with a terrorist organization. I think that's remarkable. It's a remarkable thing to me, just because it shows how they're abusing, I think, the classification system by not disclosing information about the Gitmo files. I think that there's a lot here that the defense could contest, this testimony about the nature of it. I think there's a lot that the defense could rebut in its case.
Well, Kevin, one thing, I have not been contacted by the David Coombs defense team, but if they asked me, I'd say, well, enter Andy Worthington's book, The Guantanamo Files, into evidence, because he profiled virtually all of those who have been held at Guantanamo. And when I go through the list that you ticked off, biographical information, circumstances of capture, Andy collected all of that data, and the only piece he might not have is the circumstances and date of transfer to Guantanamo, because some of those flights were secret, some of them went through the black sites before they got to Gitmo, others were held in third nations and tortured before they were sent to Guantanamo. So it strikes me that the WikiLeaks disclosures of Guantanamo were used by Worthington to confirm the information he had already reported. And as I recall from my conversation with Andy at the time, there were a handful of names that he was able to confirm and some details that he hadn't previously been able to nail down. But by and large, almost all of this information was published by Andy Worthington before WikiLeaks served up the Guantanamo files.
It's really important that you're making that point, that you're saying that, because the defense has also said that the combatant status review tribunals that were started to look at whether detainees should remain enemy combatants, what the defense has said is that a lot of the information that was put out by these tribunals was the contents of these Guantanamo files, these detainee assessment briefs. Also, there were periodic review boards that were put in place to look at prisoners. That contained information that had been made public, and it was similar to the Guantanamo files. Mm-hmm. So I think it's highly, highly debatable that more than half of the information in these briefs was not already public. And mm-hmm. In fact, I will note that in the testimony of Woods and this other analyst named Jeffrey Motes, who I highlighted, they both admitted that they had not looked at whether any of the material they reviewed in the files, in the charge documents, they did not look to see if any of that material was available in the public domain.
Well, and this gets into a whole kind of weird secrecy game that is being played. For example, we know that military computers right now are blocked from accessing the Guardian newspaper's website in England, because that's where Glenn Greenwald is publishing the revelations of Ed Snowden. We know that when Van Buren was at the State Department, they were all banned from looking at WikiLeaks on government computers. And somehow they pretend that when they proclaim a bubble of secrecy and stay inside it, that despite the fact that the rest of us can see that this emperor is completely naked, they continue to pretend that these are secrets and that nobody knows about them. It's a bizarre game.
I would just think you would be embarrassed. I just don't know. Obviously, I mean, what's remarkable is we can connect this to the Manning trial and talk about how the Army was not supposed to be looking at coverage of the cables or the war logs when they were being covered in the media, because they had the same deal where you were limiting access, or you were having warnings pop up that you would be violating the law if you read this news article. And I think it's a remarkable thing the way that they're playing this game.
Mm-hmm. Any reactions from the judge that you saw regarding this testimony that would show any skepticism, or is she a pretty good poker face?
I'm not quite sure where she falls on a lot of what has been raised so far. I don't know if she buys a lot of the arguments put forward about Manning aiding the enemy. I do not know how she would rule. I think that a conviction coming in a few weeks from now probably would expect her to do some kind of splitting the difference. I take her to be a judge that kind of averages things out. I don't know how much conviction she has to look like she's being one-sided. I do feel like she's going to try to figure out where the middle happens to be. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that speaks too well about a judge if you're only going to try to stand somewhere in the middle. That isn't it your job as a judge to find a middle.
Well, but that's what mediation is for.
Right.
This is adjudication, not mediation. They're very different.
Right. And I will say there was an important development today I want to get in before the segment wraps, which is that this 2009 Most Wanted list was not authenticated properly by the government, which means the judge denied it being entered into evidence. And quickly, for people who do not know what I mean by the Most Wanted list, this is the list that has all kinds of different secret documents that people around the world thought it would be great to see released by governments or published by WikiLeaks. And apparently the prosecutors claim that Manning would have used this as a guide to decide what to release and that he would have been searching for material based off it. And when he went off it, that was when he developed the knowledge that he would be compromising government information by providing WikiLeaks any documents. The judge actually thinks that this is the legitimate prosecution theory, even though they have put forward no evidence that Manning ever read this document. But she found three different versions of the document online, and she decided that it's not authentic. It's not properly authenticated. It doesn't meet the standards of evidence. So for the now, unless they can authenticate it, the government can't use it against Manning, which I think is very, very good because it's very good for Manning because the prosecution is trying to make these wild circumstantial claims about a document that they can't even prove he ever read.
And is there any evidence that he had a checklist, that he made his own wish list, or that he had a bucket list that he was working off? Or was he, if so, was he clever enough to have destroyed that?
I don't know. What I will say is off of his statement in court on February 28th, if we take this to be a truthful statement, because he said this under oath, so I expect it was truthful, and if we accept that it was comprehensive and he didn't leave anything out, it appears that he just decided to release information as he came across it in his work in the military. So he came across the collateral murder video. That struck a chord with him. He decided it had importance. He made a decision to release it. He came across the war log, the military incident reports. Same for the cables. Same for the Guantanamo files. I think just by serendipity, coming across some of this information, it ended up being material that was passed on to WikiLeaks.
So, Kevin, two more things that pricked up my interest in your reporting this week. One is the wrangling over the estimated value of an email list of apparently all military personnel deployed worldwide. And this was a matter of contention because the prosecution was trying to prove that the list was a thing of value over $1,000, which makes it a crime. Maybe it triggers a felony. You can define that for us. But the idea of the value of an email list is pretty hard to peg.
The difference is if it's less than $1,000 in value, then it would be much less of a crime. But over $1,000, you can charge him more. And what they're doing, it really sets up a sideshow to the serious crimes. I have to say that when I watch them argue about this global email address list, it's very ridiculous. I don't understand because what they are describing as the damage is that these military email addresses, which you and I can figure out pretty easily. The military has a standard email address system. So if you figure out that Captain John Smith is based in Baghdad and you have his email address, and if he moves back to the States and he starts to work for a branch at like Fort Drum, then you just change the email address to what the Fort Drum is, and you have his email address, so you can contact anyone in the military if you know who they are. It's not very good security if they're really worried about people getting to them. And there was a guy that talked about spear phishing and how they're afraid that they're going to get sent these links that they're going to click on, and they're going to go to a website, and then they're going to compromise their software. It just makes everyone in the military sound really incompetent and stupid. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand what's going through some of these officers' minds that sit up there and go on about the problem of having public military email addresses out there. But in any case, they want to say it's a thing of value because the global address list was put together by a database or run by some activity database, and it cost money, and they had a client license for the, I guess, email network or the servers. It cost tens of thousands of dollars for the servers. The people who were officers who were tasked with security were getting paid salaries, and that went into the costs of it. So by compromising the email address, he caused monetary damage to the military. But again, I think it's ridiculous. And
sounds to me like it's worth at least $1 billion.
And I don't know, like, how you put a value on an email address. They have not put anybody on the stand yet who can put a put an actual dollar amount to what an email address would be. I mean, how many email addresses could possibly be valuable? I mean, it's unless you've got a direct line to, like, the president. But even so, I don't understand. It's such a sideshow, and I really hesitate to spend too much time in my reporting trying to go into it beyond the fact that this could be a charge that gets Manning jail time, and that they actually consider this information, the release of the global address list, as part of aiding the enemy.
So, Kevin, I noted in your live blog from today, June 28th, that Brigadier Commander David Miller, who is in the chain of command upstream from Bradley Manning, was testifying about the fact that they did not issue a so-called Army guidance regarding access to secret information until after Manning disclosed his information to WikiLeaks. So has the government been trying to play a game here where they introduced as evidence an Army guidance and tried to indicate that it would have applied to Manning, when in fact the timeline would show that it was issued after the fact?
They haven't done that yet, but I wouldn't put it past this prosecution. But what I was doing by raising that point was just to show that there was a major security breach that was committed in the military. They have their security procedures, but it isn't just Manning who was responsible for the breach. There are people who should have been watching the system, and he was making these releases from, well, between February and April, you have data being transferred to WikiLeaks. So it shows you how insecure the system happened to be. And there are people whose job it is to keep that security, and they did not lose rank, and they did not get fired from their position, and they were not put on trial for not doing proper security. You have Manning being scapegoated for the fact that they did not have a secure system in many ways. In addition to the crime of unauthorized disclosure, there are aspects of the system not being secure that is being used against Manning. And after the fact, they issued prohibitions against the use of removable devices, mm-hmm. like a flash drive. However, I note, I think there's a link in the live updates post that I did today that related to Snowden, Edward Snowden. There was a story about how there are still many loopholes in the military for use of removable devices. So there is still quite a possibility that you could breach security if you were a soldier and wanted to take information without authorization. Of course, I caveat everything that I just say with the open admission that I would rather have information leak than be kept classified, because we have a broken classification system. And as a journalist, I enjoy reading anything that leaks out of our Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kevin, as you look at the big picture here, the rest of us have kind of been distracted from the Manning court-martial by the worldwide manhunt for Ed Snowden and his ability so far to elude American authorities. Is the bubble at Fort Meade sufficient that none of that penetrates, or is it a subtext to this court trial that is occurring in what I've dubbed the Summer of Leaks?
Nobody in the trial is referencing it, and the public affairs officers don't really want to talk about it. It's come up a little bit, but I don't think they've engaged it any more than the fact that he is in Moscow. Beyond that, they're not going to be talking about what Snowden did. And so I think that it's a nice backdrop to the trial.
And what about the story that broke this week about the FBI paid informant who had penetrated WikiLeaks? Did that surface either inside the trial or in the buzz outside the courtroom?
It hasn't surfaced, but what I will say quickly is that there are individuals that Ziggy, this informant, probably interacted with in Iceland, whose names are now entered into the record in Manning's court-martial. There were names of Icelandic officials, including Birgitta Jonsdottir, the Icelandic parliamentarian who helped with the release of the collateral murder video. That's evidence now. And then I would just add that there are Icelandic people who have been targets of the grand jury investigation impaneled in Alexandria, Virginia. And that grand jury, they've had representatives at the court-martial throughout, ever since Manning was arraigned February 2012. So it's all interconnected, and what Ziggy was doing for the FBI was definitely part of building a case for after the Manning trial, because I continue to believe that there are sealed indictments for Julian Assange and other staffers, and the political climate, I think, is ripe now, unfortunately, again, for trying to be innovative, to go after Assange and these people, even though they should have rights and cover from being accused of conspiracy to commit espionage. I thought it differently when there was all this talk about the seizure of AP records by the Justice Department. I thought the climate wasn't right to pursue WikiLeaks. But unfortunately, the way the media has covered the Snowden leaks, or I think they're whistleblowing, the way they've covered it, reproducing government propaganda about how terrorists are changing tactics, I think that clearly after the Manning trial, we should be on the lookout for movement toward prosecuting Julian Assange.
Mm-hmm. Anything you'd like to add, Kevin, as we wrap up here that we haven't covered so far?
Well, that about does it for the day, but I think I would like to leave us with the way that the Brigadier Commander Colonel David Miller characterized what his thoughts were when he first realized that Manning had committed a security breach. And this is a little lighter note. It's pretty hyperbolic. He said, "I was stunned. The last thing I anticipated was an internal security breach from one of our own." And then he said, "My read of my staff at that time, it was like a funeral-like atmosphere fell over that crowd. They were angry, sad, grief, frustrated, all at the same time." So this is how they consider Manning's act. This is how he was grandstanding on the witness stand today. And I just would leave that thought with your listeners.
Well, it sounds like this guy in uniform, who probably cuts a pretty good figure, was asking us to feel sad for him because he was hurt. He was hurt by this.
He was deeply offended by Bradley Manning, but he shouldn't be upset at all because he was responsible for preventing security breaches like this. He was a brigadier commander of Manning, and he did not lose rank at all, and he continues to have a pretty polished career.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, I imagine there'll be two or three days of trial proceedings, and then they'll break for the long 4th of July. What's the schedule look like right now?
The schedule is Monday, wrapping. The prosecution rests its case, and we're off for a week.
Oh, okay.
Because the Military District of Washington that's doing the trial has all these 4th of July events that they have to be available to staff. So we'll be off for a full week. There won't be much to update people on next week.
Mm-hmm.
But the following week, we'll have the defense beginning their case.
All right. Well, then let's plan to talk 2 weeks from today. And we'll get your latest recap as the defense launches its side of the proceedings.
Okay.
Kevin Gostola, thanks for joining me today. What are your comments? Here's my email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Thank you all for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.